Modern Love, the podcast, is supported by...
Produced by the iLab at WBUR, Boston.
From the New York Times and WBUR Boston, this is Modern Love. Stories of love, loss, and redemption. I'm your host, Meghna Chakrabarty. When Rand Richards Cooper was in his 40s, he was faced with a question. How late is too late to first become a dad? His essay is called Fatherhood, I Now Learn, is a Young Man's Game. It's read by Stanley Tucci, who starred in movies such as The Devil Wears Prada, The Lovely Bones, and Julie and Julia. His new movie is A Private War.
The first time in my life I had unprotected sex, one August night 3 summers ago, I was 45. No pill or condom, no diaphragm or IUD. None of the sundry devices deployed to keep me careering, childless, through a quarter century of romance with women I had lusted after and sometimes loved. This time, the woman was my wife, Molly, and we had decided to have a baby. Molly was 9 years younger than I, and we'd been together 8 years. We agonized about children for a long time. Then we agonized about agonizing. Deciding in midlife to become a father unfolds in a series of trenchant recognitions. A friend at a college reunion says, "Okay, you've lived one of your two lives. Now what do you want to do with the one that's left?" Or someone falls ill or dies. Several months before, Molly's brother had been given a diagnosis of lung cancer, and my mother was experiencing a spate of mysterious symptoms that would turn out to be the same terrible disease. Much more acutely than I would have at 25 or even 35, I felt the presence of ultimate things. The prospect of life and death in the balance brings a metaphysical dimension to what I began calling late-onset fatherhood. One day at the gym, I showered next to a guy busily shampooing his 4-year-old son. "Not on my forehead," the boy cried. "Why not?" his father asked. And before the boy answered, I knew exactly what he was going to say. "It gets in my eyes." With perfect clarity, I recalled the outrage of that stinging discomfort and my own father saying, exactly as this father now said, "Then close them." I thought about how having a child extends you through time, genetically into the future, but also into the past, reconnecting you to perceptions and experiences you have all but forgotten. I felt tired of living only in the present. The physical side of late-onset fatherhood was less thrilling. There's a keen incongruity in trying to open up this huge new dimension in your life, even as life announces its intention of closing you down, starting with your physical prowess. I was already feeling pretty creaky, the consequence of a nasty basketball habit I couldn't kick, ankle sprains, back spasms, and, finally, the mother of all sports injuries, a torn ACL. Now you can either alter your lifestyle to fit your knee or alter your knee to fit your lifestyle, the surgeon said. The belated father faces a daunting gamble. Will a baby indeed keep you young, open up some replenishing new vitality? Or will it do just the opposite? Will I have the energy to be an older father, the patience, the knees? In the unsentimental terms of evolutionary psychology, would becoming a father prolong my peak and delay my plummet? Or, as a middle-aged man playing a young man's game, was I merely setting myself up for an even bigger fall? That autumn, as Molly and I were helping friends drop their daughter off at college, I saw a geezer father amid the throng of parents hobbling alongside his son. "You're looking at me," I said to Molly. I did the math. Even if we got pregnant tomorrow, I'd be pushing 70 when our child graduated from college. And we weren't getting pregnant tomorrow. Nature was playing its cruel trick on those who wait. For years you wouldn't, and now it seems you can't. 6 months went by. A year. Nothing. Nothing but the pregnancy test kit with its dreaded thin blue line that kept telling us, no, not yet, try again. After 18 months, we handed ourselves over to the fertility industry. For Molly, ultrasounds. For me, semen analysis. I had become obsessed with doubt about my 46-year-old sperm. All those decades I spent thwarting biology, wasn't there bound to be payback? In adversity, you fall back into primitive thinking, full of self-reproach and neurotic bodily metaphor. My stream diverted and grown fetid. My once robust vintage, now sadly corked, turned to mold. Waiting for the doctor's office to call with my results, I made the mistake of consulting a semen analysis website with its nightmare list of abnormalities. Hematospermia, blood in semen. Asthenozoospermia, poor motility. And creepiest of all, necrospermia. When the phone rang, I was gaping at drawings of sperm with shriveled heads or two tails, a gallery of misshapen monsters. But nothing like that showed up, and eventually came a warm spring morning when Molly rose early after a restless night. From the bathroom came the sound of trickle, trickle. I followed her in. The little pregnancy test wand sat on the side of the tub. We peered at it. Oh, my God, Molly said. So much still awaited us, but at least we were done waiting for the waiting. And I found myself eager to say goodbye to life as I knew it. That same day, while leaving the gym, driving out of the parking lot in my convertible, top-down tunes blasting from the car stereo, I passed a guy loading two kids into a minivan. He was a few years younger than I, and as I went by, he looked my way with a big, rueful smile, gesturing back and forth. You take mine, he was saying, and I'll take yours. Meaning the kids, the car, the life. I knew how I appeared to him. A man emerging from fatherhood into the sunlit freedoms of midlife. He was thinking he couldn't wait to be me. Little did he know, I was smiling like a crazy fool because I was about to become him. Fast forward 9 months, past the fathomless sorrow of the death of Molly's brother, past the thrill of our first shadowy ultrasound and the comedy of parenting classes, where I would burp a plastic doll alongside fellow fathers-to-be, some of them closer in age to their impending babies than to me, to a sunny afternoon in January. That was when our daughter, Larkin Fair Cooper, uttered her first squawk in room 646 of the appropriately named Bliss Building at Hartford Hospital. The maternity ward practiced the rooming-in concept, whereby the husband, formerly that awkward auxiliary figure drinking coffee in the hallway, can now be in on the action. Our room came with a cot, and I spent that first night dozing to Van Morrison, Larkin on my chest, making aimless little jerking movements. Filing her tiny fingernails with an emery board, sharing a pizza as she slept alongside, Molly and I felt the sweet intensity of being new parents cocooned with a baby. Time stops. The world with its news and duties recedes, and the three of you experience an ecstatic, ferocious tenderness that takes familiar old emotions and mixes them in powerful new concoctions. I feel like we're being reprogrammed, I said. And yet, I was still the same old person, as events all too soon reminded me. Our very first day home from the hospital, fetching Molly a glass of juice in the kitchen, I bent over to take an ice tray from the freezer when, wham, somebody kicked a dagger-toed boot into my lower back. I went down, ice trays flying. These were the same back spasms that felled me on the basketball court a year ago. I couldn't get up, couldn't even sit up. The pain was too intense. Not now, I thought. Not when Molly still had her stitches in and needed to be resting with our baby. Not when I intended to wait on the two of them hand and foot. I wanted to be the do-everything guy. And now I was going to be the do-nothing guy, bedbound for the next 3 days, an invalid whose wife would have to bring him his medicine and carry his urine to the toilet in a bucket. Lying there, I writhed in a misery that verged on despair. For 72 hours, life had been serving up sweet joy and exaltation, but right now, all I could think about was my failure as a father. I recalled years of boyhood sports fun with my own father, epic battles of one-on-one basketball, marathon tennis matches on hot summer days, followed by a race to the beach and a leap into the water. My child, I was convinced, would never have that with me. Larkin would know me as a fragile, gray, grandfatherly presence. As for her actual grandparents, she would experience them barely, or not at all. I had known my grandparents well when I was a kid. Two of them had seen me into adulthood. Larkin would miss out on all that, and it was my fault, all of it. I had waited too long. I had selfishly hoarded the vigor of my life and used it up on myself. Molly found me lying on the kitchen floor, weeping tears of rage. She held my head in her lap. "I wanted to do everything," I said, "and now I'm useless." "It's okay," she said. "I love you so much." I knew she did, and thank God for that. But would it be enough? I pictured Larkin asleep in the bassinet upstairs. She was so tiny. I felt so old. There was such a long way to go. Our house has a first-floor guest room just beyond the dining room and down a short hallway with a queen-size futon. I saw my journey there as if from an ant's-eye view, looking up at the legs of the dining room table, the handholds on baseboards and door frames. From upstairs came the sound of our brand new baby, screaming to be nursed. "Go," I said to Molly. "But first I need you to get me the Vicodin and the Flexeril." She did. And so began the great adventure into late-onset fatherhood as I gulped the painkillers and crawled, whimpering, across the kitchen floor.
That's Stanley Tucci, reading Rand Richards Cooper's essay, "Fatherhood, I Now Learn, is a Young Man's Game." We'll catch up with Rand after the break. When we talked to Rand Richards Cooper, he told us more about the moment when he was crawling across the kitchen floor.
And it just so happened that at that moment, and I didn't write about this in the piece, my mother-in-law walked in, and she was a Midwesterner with a very laconic sense of humor, and it was dim in the kitchen, and she looked down and she said, "Rand, is that you down there?" And I said, it is, but go on, Molly needs you upstairs." So she carefully stepped over me. And I think I was simultaneously laughing and crying at the same time.
That wasn't the only time when tears and laughter went hand in hand in the early days of Larkin's life. Her birth came at a time when the family was hit with more illness. Rand's mother was fighting cancer, and a few months after she was born, Rand was also diagnosed with cancer.
And so I had the almost surreal moment of bringing my 5-month-old baby to the nursing home where my mother was dying, and I had just been diagnosed with a quite serious melanoma. So we sat there with this beautiful little baby laughing and playing, my mother within weeks of death, and myself facing a potentially pretty grave illness. So the intensity of this life moment, with the darkest and scariest things and the brightest and most vividly loveliest things jostling with each other, struck me as something that I had to try to give language to.
Though Rand recovered, his mother died when Larkin was 6 months old, And Rand still feels the pain not only of losing her, but also of losing the relationship that might have existed between Larkin and her grandmother.
I waited as long as I did to have children, in part because I was doing things with my life that were intensely rewarding to me. And I traveled and I wrote books and I loved that life. But I truly, truly regret that Larkin hasn't gotten to know my mother other than through our stories. When Larkin was about to be born, my mother took a copy of one of my favorite books, Le Petit Prince, and my mother just wrote a note saying, "To whoever you are, I love you."
Larkin is 12 now, and Rand told us a little bit about the person she's become.
She has always wanted a sibling, but we told her, "Look, we barely eked you out. There aren't going to be any siblings." So she has managed to use a certain amount of guilt that is associated with our refusal to give her a sibling in order to extort from us the maximum number and kind of pets. So the love and care of animals is just huge with Larkin, and so is reading. She loves jokes, and we kid around a lot. It's a lovely relationship and one that is rewarding to me every day.
That's Rand Richards Cooper. He's a fiction writer, critic, and essayist living in Connecticut with his family. His books include The Last to Go and Big as Life. We've got more after the break. Here's Stanley Tucci, who, at age 58, has a lot in common with Rand Richards Cooper.
As an older father, it is exactly everything you think. I raised stepchildren when I was younger, then children with my first wife who passed away, and now I have two younger children. So everyone I've raised sort of ranges from like 34, 33, something, to 7 months. So reading this is exactly is exactly what you feel.
Thanks again to Stanley Tucci for reading this week's essay. His new movie is A Private War, in theaters now. Here's Daniel Jones, editor of the Modern Love column for the New York Times.
A really common struggle I see in submissions to Modern Love and in some of what we publish is this idea of trying to perfectly time your life and to game it out in a way that's optimal. And so often when that has to do with having children, there's this sweet spot of having children where people have established their careers and they're comfortable with themselves and they've done the travel they want to do and all of that. And then they turn to having children and can't, or they have a child and they feel like they're too old and now they worry that they're going to be, as Rand does, he's going to be 70 when his child is like heading off to college, and conceding that there were going to be times when his wife was going to be not know which person was needier, him or the child. And it's such a sort of perfect image encapsulated at the end when he's like on painkillers and dragging himself across the floor to try to be helpful.
Next week, Finn Wittrock.
The thing about the physical side is that I can talk all I want about what I've been through, what it felt like to grow up with chronic illness and to know nothing else, with the science and the diagnoses and the dates and everything that can be measured. But the faded cuts and holes and lines that speckle my body are the closest I can get to proof. Eventually, scars will fade, but you can't uncut skin.
Modern Love is a production of the New York Times and WBUR, Boston's NPR station. It's produced, directed, and edited by Jessica Alpert, Caitlin O'Keefe, and John Parati. Original scoring and sound design by Matt Reed. The idea for the Modern Love podcast was conceived by Lisa Tobin. Iris Adler is our executive producer. Daniel Jones is the editor of Modern Love for the New York Times and advisor to the show. Music for the podcast, courtesy of APM. If you love listening to the show, leave us a rating or a review on Apple Podcasts. It helps new listeners find us. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. See you next week.